Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people whose guidance on these matters I value more than our first guest. He is David Goldman, also known as Spengler, the pseudonym he uses in his Asia Times column. He is also the author of an important book, How Civilizations Die. And we'll be talking a little bit later in the program, David, but I want to commend to you as well a movie that I saw last night about The Death of a Nation by Dinesh D'Souza. I don't know if you've had a chance to take a look at it yet, but it's a very good, very good film. And we'll talk more about it with Dr. Paul Kengor.
Dinesh does great work.
He does, and this is the best yet, I think. Let me ask you, you cover very closely developments in a country that doesn't get nearly the attention I think it requires, namely Turkey. There has been some serious uptick, shall we say, in the express displeasure of the United States with Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his regime over this pastor Andrew Brunson, leading to President Trump threatening sanctions and actually now having imposed some. Talk a little bit about what's going on there, if you would, David, and the larger context of what's happening in Turkey and why it should matter so much to us.
Turkey has been for years the main supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is the umbrella organization for Islamism and the propagation of Sharia law and Sunni terrorism in the world. It is not a friend of the United States. It used to be a NATO ally, but it went Islamist over the last dozen years. Its president, Tayyip Erdogan, is a megalomaniac. He's taken on the United States and bit off more than he can chew. And he's used Pastor Brunson as a hostage to try to force us to extradite some of his political enemies from the United States to Turkey, which we've correctly refused to do. After months of negotiations, the United States simply lost its patience, and President Trump, magnificently right, told Turkey that he would impose sanctions if they didn't release Pastor Brunson. Now, Turkey is a typical third world kleptocracy. It is hugely dependent on foreign credit, and Erdogan was really stupid to take on the U.S. because now, with the threat of sanctions, his currency continues to collapse, the economy is going into freefall, and eventually he'll be replaced. So this is an example of the United States using its power against a tin pot dictator who can't stand up to us, and I completely support President Trump's tough stance towards Erdogan.
Good. Well, I do as well. There's another tin pot dictatorship just to Turkey's south, Iran. Talk a little bit about the possibility that the president is having a similarly salutary effect with his approach to the mullahs of Iran.
Well, the Iranian currency is in free fall. Large parts of the economy are shutting down. They can't import anything. And there are mass protests. This is it's the most mismanaged economy in the world. It's basically, it's a Middle Eastern Venezuela. Even when Obama gave them $150 billion, their economy was still in terrible shape. And now with the threat of sanctions, it's imploding. And there are a couple of ways this could go. It's entirely possible that the Revolutionary Guards hardliners will stage their own coup and take control of the country and threaten oil exports coming out of the Straits of Hormuz. In that case, there'd be a war. We would have to use military force to prevent those threats. That's certainly a risk, but it's a risk worth taking because you can't let the West be blackmailed by by these thugs. Another possibility is that the regime might be overthrown. There are mass protests of the country. There are many ethnic minorities like the Iranian Kurds, Iranian Arabs, Balochis, and other minorities who are very upset with the regime. So I think it would be well within the purview of the United States, and I have no direct knowledge of this, to encourage some of that discontent and to try to bring about regime change. Again, from the outside, very hard to predict, but I think we're going in the right direction.
A question on that very quickly, David Goldman. I had Harold Rode on the program earlier in the week, and he made the point that encouraging those fault lines, demographic, national, ethnic fault lines in Iran, might actually play into the hands of the regime by appealing to those who hate the mullahs, but nonetheless are proud of the nation of Iran, to back them rather than, you know, see the country come apart. Any quick thoughts on that?
There is always the risk that the hardcore Revolutionary Guards types will simply seize control from President Rouhani and take a much more extreme stance threatening the United States, in which case we could be in a war. That's not optimal, but when you're dealing with thugs like that, you have to take that risk. So Harold is absolutely right in his analysis, but in my view, we nonetheless should be putting all the pressure we can on them.
Yeah. Let me ask you very quickly to summarize an important piece that you recently wrote about an issue that we haven't talked about here on Secure Freedom Radio, but we will be doing so, a so-called nation-state law that Israel has recently adopted to widespread condemnation. Tell us about it.
The law simply puts Israel on par with most of the European nation states. It says that it's the nation state of the Jewish people, that Hebrew is the national language, that the Jewish calendar is the national calendar, that certain holidays are national holidays, and so forth. No different than you get in Estonia, Latvia, Poland, Czech Republic, lots of other places. There's nothing ethnocentric or exclusionary about it. This is normalization. The reason there's so much upset, Frank, is because the world, a large part of the world, doesn't accept normalization in Israel because normalization means a permanent Jewish state. A large part of the Muslim world cannot accept the idea of a permanent Jewish state. So the Europeans and others have played a sort of game of strategic ambiguity about Israel's permanence. That's why no one except the United States and a couple of other countries puts an embassy in Jerusalem, which is Israel's capital. It's all about accommodating a Muslim delusion that Israel is a temporary colonial presence as opposed to a permanent nation state of the Jewish people.
Yeah, and entirely legitimate as such. Fascinating, as always. David Goldman, we learned so much from each of these conversations. I appreciate you sharing them with us, and I hope you will come back to do so in the very near future. We'll do more of it soon. Next up, Kevin Freeman joins us. We'll talk with him about China and what its activities mean for all of us right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Kevin Freeman. I believe he is one of our country's preeminent authorities on and, well, duty experts with respect to economic warfare. GlobalEconomicWarfare.com is the name of his blog. You can read two superb books on the subject, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. And soon you will be able to see on your video screens Kevin in what he calls the Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. I had a chance to do some taping with him earlier this week, and I'm very excited about this product and look forward to hearing more about its rollout. Kevin, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, there are some things that seem to be afoot, Kevin, that I believe have been informed by your analysis, or certainly or at least validating it. You did a piece recently about if this isn't the Trump doctrine, it should be. Tell us what that's about and what its implications are, if in fact that's now the policy of the United States government.
Well, it's kind of a reversal of what Nixon did. Nixon, when we were in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, made overtures and connections with China, and that disrupted the Soviet plans somewhat in the Cold War. President Trump recognizes that at the moment, as bad as Putin is, as bad as Russia has been, how they've interfered in elections and hacked things and so forth, they've invaded neighbors, and all of those things are all true. And it's, you know, I'm not a Putin apologist by any means, but he recognizes that the far greater threat that we face is China. China's economy is stronger. China's rapidly building their military. China is not in this for what can we get out of it, as Putin might be. China is instead looking at a 100-year marathon to where they dominate the planet, and they displace the United States entirely. And so he has made overtures to Russia that I'm hopeful are evidence that he has recognized the greater threat in China, and he realizes that if we can point out to President Putin that China's a threat to them too, that maybe we can have some cooperation and at least slow this Chinese juggernaut.
You know, it's been one of the great mysteries to me that Putin seems so indifferent to the obvious threat that China represents to Russia, whether it's their immense buildup militarily, in part made possible by Russian infusions of technology and armaments, and in part, the fact that the Chinese are simply taking over large swaths of Siberia and the eastern stretches of Russia. It's inevitable that they will come to blows, as they have in the past, it seems to me. And Putin seems to be either indifferent about it or taking kind of the famous Louis XV line, après moi le déluge. You know, it'll be somebody else's problem. I'll be long gone. But it's our problem at the moment, for sure, Kevin. And whether this is the doctrine that the Trump administration is pursuing, or whether it's simply what they should be, it seems to be getting greater resonance, including on Capitol Hill and in the business community. Talk a little bit about the new National Defense Authorization Act that's just been finalized, and the business community's rather surprising response to it, given its past behavior.
Even just a few years ago, when I would go in and meet either in the Pentagon or with the House or the Senate, and I'd share concerns about China, they were just literally ignored. And I was told that China is our great trading partner, and they're a great friend, and you know they would never do anything to harm us because the blowback would hurt them. And so when I saw in the Wall Street Journal an article with this quote from James Lewis from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, he says, 3 years ago, if you talked about doing things against China, the business community would push back. They don't push back anymore. And that's because the business community has been directly in the crosshairs of China. They've stolen our technology. They've hired away people. They have forced technology transfers. They've had unfair trading practices against us. And the business community is finally waking up to the fact that China is not our friend, and they have been harming American business, not benefiting. They've not kept their word on trade deals and so forth. So as a result, the climate has shifted for the first time. You know, 10 years I've been warning about China, and for the first time people are beginning to wake up, which is step number one, realize that we are in a global economic war. What we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you about that, Kevin, because I wonder whether the business community has fully embraced that idea or whether they just are tired of getting screwed in the commercial sense, but not really yet prepared to recognize that the national security implications of what's happening here transcend the, you know, day-to-day or micro considerations of one company or even an entire industrial sector.
Well, I think initially they're looking at it from a self-interest standpoint, not from the national security standpoint. I mean, there's no question they're realizing that it's hurting their bottom line. It's compounding their economic problems. But they need to step back and say, this isn't just a matter of whether our profit goes up or down in the next quarter. This is a matter of whether our nation survives over the long term. And the national security implications are absolute. And they were ignored because of the profitability. They're no longer being ignored, and at least that gives us an opening to make a case.
I want to salute you, Kevin, not only for making that case as articulately and as assiduously as you do, and we've talked about your book, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and your blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com. We've talked about your new show, Economic War Room, with Kevin Freeman. I did want to also mention you're a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy, which we prize. And also, you created a very important instrument for trying to help businesses think about those national security equities, the National Security Investment Consultants Institute. Talk a little bit about that work and why this is such an important transformation that we need the business sector in this country to begin, I guess you'd say, coming alongside with the national security community for their mutual survival.
Well, I grew up in the investment community. My father is a stockbroker. I worked for a decade for John Templeton, who was the premier world's most famous global investor. And what I realized is that global investing, people invest where they can get the greatest potential profit. They rarely think of social benefits from investing. And there's a whole industry that came along that said, well, if you'll invest in this and divest yourself from tobacco, we can make some social changes. But there's no one who's ever said to an individual that where your investments are placed may make a difference in the security of your nation. And so we thought, well, how do we accomplish that? We train investment advisors, because if you control the money, you have the attention of American business. So by training investment advisors of national security risks, we reach clients and the clients say, hey, I don't want my money to be invested in such a way that it harms the security of our future for my children and grandchildren and so forth. And so we've trained them. We did one training exercise that you were a part of in Oklahoma at Oklahoma Wesleyan University. We did another one at Hillsdale College at their Kirby Center in Washington. And the response is amazing. People have never thought that their few dollars investment could make a difference. But when we collect them together, it's a very powerful instrument to move both American business, but also to make investments in things that can secure our future.
Yeah. You know, Kevin, this is important on so many different levels. Back, I believe it was 2004, the Center for Security Policy was one of those working very hard to try to get state public pension funds to divest terror, as we called it, to stop investing in companies that were doing business with terror sponsoring regimes, notably, but not exclusively, Iran. And it had a very profound effect, I think. There's no question about it. There were some 30 states across the country that adopted legislation, not all of it perfect, frankly, but it was salutary in terms of signaling that we were going to start paying attention to what was being done with our money. In that case, particularly money of people like police officers and firefighters, for heaven's sakes, who understand perhaps better than most the implications of terrorism for our communities. Kevin, I did want to ask you one other thing before we run out of time. We talked about Russia a moment ago. You've called to my attention that the Russians have liquidated, by some estimates, as much as 84% of their holdings of U.S. debt instruments, with implications and impact on T-bill offerings and the like. Walk us through what's going on with the Russians in this regard. Are they clearing their decks for some sort of hostile action against us, would you say? Or is this the hostile action in its own right?
Well, it is a hostile action in its own right, and people don't realize that. Russia at the end of last year had over $102 billion, according to CNN, invested in U.S. Treasury bonds. They were one of the largest holders of our debt. Because we spend more than we take in every year, we have to go to the capital markets and we have to raise $600, $700 billion at the current run rate every year, more in borrowed money than we did last year. But Russia has taken the opposite. Instead of buying more of our treasury bonds, which is the normal approach because their economy is going and so forth, they've actually liquidated to where at the end of May they had less than $15 billion. So that's where you get the 84% drop. $85, $87, $88 billion of treasury bonds were sold by the Russians into the marketplace. The net result of that, and they bought gold with it, is what they turned around and bought. The net result of that is that when our government's going out trying to issue more debt, Russia's selling the same debt into the same market. A buyer can buy from one of two sources, and there's only so much capital that goes around. It makes the interest rate go up. We have to pay more as a result, which impacts individuals. Mortgage rates go up. The cost of capital to companies as they want to go expand and grow, the cost of them goes up. It impacts our economy. So it creates a push of interest rates higher at the same time that the Federal Reserve is also loosening their balance sheet. They're trying to raise rates and they're trying to exit some of this monetary stimulus.
It's so good to talk to you, Kevin Freeman, even when the tidings are not always happy. We'll be talking more about the China piece of all of this with Michael Mazza right after this. But thank you so much for giving us this introduction, and your insights are greatly appreciated. Next up, as promised, Michael Mazza, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined, I think, for the first time, I'm very pleased to say, by Michael Mazza. He is a visiting fellow at the Foreign and Defense Policy Studies Program at the American Enterprise Institute. It is a celebrated organization here in the Washington, D.C., with which I have been associated off and on over the years and admire greatly. He has been managing its executive program on national security policy and strategy at AEI. He is a graduate, I am impressed by this, of my alma mater, the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and a very welcome guest. Michael, it's good to have you. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
Let me ask you, first of all, you have been writing recently about Taiwan, which is a tremendously important country that unfortunately gets little attention, if any, and mostly it's rather badly treated by America. Talk a little bit about the importance of Taiwan as you see it and the extent to which the Chinese seem to be ratcheting up the pressure on it, possibly as a precursor to what they've long promised they would do, which is to take it back by force.
Yeah, look, things are very concerning right now in the Taiwan Strait. I think Taiwan is important to the United States for a number of reasons. For years now, it's been a top 10 or top 15 trade partner of the United States. Many people don't know that. It's a country of only 23 million people. It is sitting on the what we could consider the front lines of the competition between the free world, led by the United States, and China, led by the Chinese Communist Party. It has geostrategic importance, given its geographic location, sitting right off the coast of China and situated between U.S. allies, Japan, and the Philippines. And it's also important in the ideological competition. Taiwan has transformed itself into this bustling, thriving democracy, and its example shows that the Chinese Communist Party's argument that democracy is not suited to a Chinese society is simply false.
Right. This, I think, feeds in part the Chinese determination to crush Taiwan. They have, for many years, as you know, Michael Mazza, been simply trying to buy it out, it seems, and had some considerable success, particularly under the previous presidency. The current president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, has come to power on a much more nationalist line, as I understand it. Talk a bit about what the Chinese are doing now to ratchet up the pressure on the Taiwanese government to bring it to heel.
Yeah, absolutely. Just before getting into that, I would point to two larger trends that we're seeing right now. One is in Taiwan, regardless of the who the government is at any given time, we've seen this consistent trend over the past 30 years almost in which People on Taiwan are identifying as Taiwanese rather than Chinese, increasingly so, and are increasingly in favor of independence at some point in the future and increasingly opposed to unification. And those trends are ongoing. They've been consistent. And they come now, or they're increasingly coming to a head at a time when unification is perhaps becoming more important as China. Xi Jinping is a very nationalistic president. His country is facing economic headwinds. It would be doing so even without the U.S.-China trade tensions, and that is making unification with Taiwan more important. And so we've seen now, over the past 2 years, this sustained pressure campaign that China has been imposing on Taiwan. And it's been a number of things that they've done. They've isolated Taiwan diplomatically. So that means they've stolen some of Taiwan's diplomatic allies. They've frozen it out of important international meetings, like Interpol's summit, for example, or the World Health Organization summit. They have used their economic leverage to attempt to punish Taiwan. So immediately after Tsai Ing-wen's election a couple of years ago, as the current president of Taiwan, they severely cut back tourism to the island. And they've also attempted to intimidate Taiwan by increasing the pace and the scope of military exercises and operations around Taiwan.
Yeah, and there was this pressure on U.S. airlines, too. Did you mention that? And if not, tell us about that. Not just U.S. airlines, I should say, on airlines internationally, but in particular, how American, Delta, and United have responded to that pressure.
So, you know, part of what China is trying to do is in a way, erase Taiwan from the international community. It wants other countries, other peoples to not sympathize, to not understand the challenges that Taiwan faces, making it easier for China to act as it pleases over the next few years. So as part of that effort, back in the spring, China sent this letter to 44 international airlines demanding that they stop referring to Taiwan as a country, essentially. So if you want to fly to Taipei, your website, the website that you go to now should say you want to fly to Taipei, China, rather than Taipei, Taiwan. A lot of international airlines eventually caved to this pressure, some more quickly than others. The American airlines held out until the very last moment, and they settled on a middle ground, which was essentially to remove references to Taiwan from their airlines, but not to say that cities in Taiwan were part of China. So if you want to fly to Taipei and you go to the United website, you can see that you can fly to Taipei, no country named. Seemed like a reasonable compromise.
But not to the Chinese.
The Chinese are unhappy. They consider this an incomplete response to their demand. It's unclear what kind of action they may take to coerce the airlines into to fully complying. But this should be really troubling to Americans, because not only is this aimed at isolating Taiwan, but this is an attack on the freedom of speech here in the United States. This is an act of censorship of American companies and American individuals by a hostile foreign power. And it's something that the United States government really shouldn't stand for.
And my guess is, and Michael, you know vastly more about this than I do, but my guess is this is likely to be seen by the Chinese, how we respond, as a bellwether for whether we're going to resist some of the other pressure that they're bringing to bear. And ultimately, if they decide to move even more aggressively, more violently against the island, whether that will be met with force in response. A lot of other factors will go into that calculation. But I wanted to turn to something that you wrote about, I think an important piece at AEI.org, entitled Crafting America's Free and Open Indo-Pacific Strategy. And this keyed off of something that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce before heading off to Asia this week for meetings with some of his counterparts in ASEAN and elsewhere. Talk a little bit about the emerging Trump Indo-Pacific strategy. And specifically, we've been talking on the show a lot, Michael, about the organizing theme, it seems. Kevin Freeman in the previous segment talked about it as the Trump doctrine, that it's really all about countering China. Is that how you see it?
You know, I think that the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy is is about more than countering China, but that is certainly a central aspect of it. The administration began to roll this out last fall, really. And while sort of the rhetoric was very good, there weren't a lot of what I call meat on the strategy bones. So this idea that we wanted a free and open Indo-Pacific strategy, again, that sounds very nice. What does it mean and how are we going to achieve it? And we're finally getting some answers to that question. So Secretary Pompeo on Monday explained that free and open means a variety of things. It means free trade. It means free access to the global commons. You know, that means freedom of the seas, freedom of the skies. It means effective governance and protection of human rights. And of course, all of these things are important ways inimical to the Chinese Communist Party.
At odds with what they're insisting on, for example, in the South China Sea, notably. And that brings me to the question of, you know, what the practical implications of this strategy are as you see it. We've seen, you know, freedom of navigation operations in the among those islands that the Chinese have fabricated in the South China Sea. We've seen, as I understand it, some destroyers run through the Strait of Taiwan as a, you know, again, freedom of navigation exercise. Is that, in fact, the extent of it? And what more needs to be done?
It's a good question. It's hard to say at this point whether or not that's the extent of it. You're right. We've seen more freedom of navigation operations under the Trump administration than we had previously, and they've been a bit more robust. But as far as we can tell from what's publicly been said and what we're seeing, there isn't a broader strategy for tackling the challenge of the South China Sea in particular. I think that we can get there. I have a report coming out on U.S. strategy in Southeast Asia next week in which I discuss this, and I think it requires a couple of different tracks. So on the one hand, there's the sort of the deterrence and dissuasion tracks, getting China to stop what they're doing, and that is a mix of enhancing our military posture in the region, and also responding much more strongly to Chinese actions in the South China Sea, and not necessarily in the South China Sea, imposing economic costs and political costs on leaders. There's also a diplomatic track. The U.S. position for a long time has been to take no position on the disputes themselves, but encourage peaceful resolution. Well, you know, that's not happening absent U.S. leadership. It should be clear at this point.
What is happening is that we're losing ground to the Chinese, it seems. In some cases, quite literally manufactured ground in these archipelagos.
There's an argument to be made that essentially China has already achieved what it wants to achieve in the South China Sea. I think we can keep things from getting worse, but in failing to react to what China has done over the past 4 years or so, We've dug ourselves into a hole, no doubt about it.
Yeah. We have to leave it at that for the moment, Michael Mazza, but I very much appreciate your insights and in particular calling attention to the importance geostrategically, ideologically, economically, and in every other sense of the word, really, of the Republic of Taiwan and the importance of our standing with them. Michael, thank you so much for what you're doing at AEI. I hope you'll come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Paul Kengor right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's so good to have another friend and much admired colleague with us. He is Dr. Paul Kengor. He is a professor of political science and the executive director of the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College, an extraordinary college in Pennsylvania. He is the author of numerous best-selling books on all kinds of important historical insights, including several of my personal favorites, The Communist, Frank Marshall Davis, and The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mentor. He is the author of The Judge, concerning a great American by the name of Judge William P. Clark, and also A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th century. Paul Kenger, I could go on and on with just the introduction, but I'll lose all my time to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming back on. It's so good to talk, and I'm sorry it's been so long between times. Welcome.
Oh, yeah. You're too nice, Frank, and it's always good to be back with you, and you call me anytime.
I'm going to do it, and we're going to do it for a full hour soon because we've got a lot to catch up on. Paul, I know you haven't seen a film that I was lucky enough to catch in a premiere at Washington last night, but it's opening in theaters all over the country, 1,000 of them, as a matter of fact, this weekend, and I commend Dinesh D'Souza's new movie, Death of a Nation, to you and to all of our listeners. It's an extraordinary piece of film, but I think you particularly will appreciate it because it tracks with an awful lot of the history that you have been revealing that goes very much against what is largely passing for, well, academics and scholarship in our institutions in this country, specifically with respect to the kinship between, in fact, the direct relationship that connected the so-called progressives, the left, socialists, democratic socialists, communists, Alinskyites, call them what you will, on the one hand, and the Nazis and fascists on the other. The conventional wisdom says, no, the Nazis and fascists are on the right, but actually, you and Dinesh, I think, agree that they're very much peas in a pod on the left, are they not?
Well, they are indeed, Frank. They are ideologies of the left. And in fact, Nazi it's not an acronym, but it's short for Nationalist Socialist. And the full title was the Nationalist Socialist German Workers Party. And if that sounds like a party of the right, I mean, you know, come on, folks, just think about it. Nationalists, socialists, workers. That's the kind of stuff that comes from the left. And of course, Hitler and the Germans and the Nazis were statists. I mean, they weren't pushing guys like Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek and pushing for laissez-faire economics and for, cutting tax rates down to flat tax of 10% across the board. Now, these were big government people. They wanted to use the force, the power of the state to round up people. They were about state sponsorship of companies, taking over of companies. Now, they weren't communists, right? I mean, communists are further to the left on the spectrum, but nonetheless, they're socialists. They were socialists. So this idea that they're right wing, and really, Frank, so for people to say, well, how are they coming up with that? All right, let me be totally honest with this, with what's going on here. The left has succeeded, or at least tried to succeed, in framing ultranationalists and racists as on the right. Okay, and that's what they've tried to do, which thus puts the KKK on the right. Okay, but if you're really looking at the economic spectrum and the idea, modern conservatism and free markets, and that's about small government, not about the force of the state. So it really has nothing in common with at least how we should understand modern conservatism, and certainly I would say modern libertarianism as well.
Yeah. There are so many points to be made about this, but just several highlights of Dinesh's film, which again I know tracks with your own research, is the Democrats' connection to some of the most odious elements of this 20th and 21st century nightmare brought by totalitarians, notably slavery, eugenics, and the sort of violent response when you're not getting your way. These are hallmarks, really, of the left and the Democratic Party, as he documents pretty persuasively. I'm interested in a piece that you had in the American Spectator just yesterday, Dr. Paul Kenger, about the collusion between progressives with the Kremlin in a presidential election. This has very interesting overtones for our present moment. Talk about it.
Yeah, well, let me address the first point first there, Frank, on it's not just the Democrats with race and the KKK, but even liberals and progressives. And I kind of give you one person that kind of sums it all up. Margaret Sanger is an icon in progressivism and liberalism. In fact, if they could create a progressive Mount Rushmore, right, they'd be chiseling out her face first. And Margaret Sanger, who's the founder of Planned Parenthood, she had a Negro project. Her her idea with birth control was less about abortion and population control than it was eugenics, about what she called race improvement.
And the term, for those not familiar with it, Paul, is using various techniques to eliminate those in the population you don't want. And whether it was Jews for the Nazis or before that, you know, handicapped individuals or others with limitations, it's the most horrific kind of murderous, well, justification for murder, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, and which is why the KKK actually liked Margaret Sanger and invited her, and she spoke May 1926 to the Silver Lake, New Jersey, women's chapter of the KKK. And we know about that, Frank, and I know this off the top of my head because I have my students read it in my 20th century course at Grove City College every spring semester. Pages 366 to 367 of her memoirs, Margaret Sanger's 1938 memoirs, published by Houghton Mifflin, one of the top publishing houses in the country at the time, she talks. She's got two full pages talking about speaking in May 1926 to the KKK. And she was such a hit, and they loved her so much that she said, she's almost bragging about it, Frank, in the book, that she said a dozen additional speaking offers were proffered to her that very evening. And she was there so late and so long after watching them, she describes them marching around with inflamed crosses and white hoods and everything else, that she missed her train back to New York and had to spend the night there in Silver Lake, New Jersey. So Margaret Sanger, KKK, eugenics, progressive movement. Today, Planned Parenthood's highest honor is the Sanger Award, and which they've given to Hillary Clinton. They've given to Nancy Pelosi. This is all connected. And for people, well, Sanger didn't do what the Nazis did. No, but here's the difference. That Sanger said, I want to refine the gene pool. I want race improvement by controlling it through reproduction, through birth control, and even forced sterilization. Hitler said, well, I'll go one step further. Let's not mess around with controlling before people were born. Let's deal with people who are already born as well. So we'll kill the polluters of the gene pool, the undesirables, the Jews, the gypsies, the Slavs, the handicapped, the mentally disabled, the old folks, the senile, the infirm, what Margaret Sanger called imbeciles and morons and idiots.
Wow. You know, what's so fascinating about this, Paul, and we have to get you back for a much longer conversation, but as you're talking, I'm just thinking, the organization that has arguably done more damage to our public consciousness about these sorts of challenges in our own time, because of its role as an instrument of political warfare aimed at suppressing people whose political views it does not like, is an outfit called the Southern Poverty Law Center. And the SPLC, of course, earned its chops going after the KKK, but it's now in the service of folks like the Planned Parenthood Organization and others on the radical left that are, unfortunately, truth be told, spawned by basically the same horrible ideology. And I find it stunning when you see these dots connected. And again, I'm going to have to let you go with this, but Paul Kanger, there's much more to talk about. But in the meantime, I hope you and our listeners will make a point of going on this critical opening weekend of Death of a Nation, Dinesh D'Souza's film. Come back to us again, sir, if you will, very soon. And I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.